Shop introduction of our attendee.
So,
once again, we are very blessed and rejoiced that we get to invite Ajahn all the way from Perth just to come and share the teaching of Dharma with us. So we have here with Ajahn Brahmani. And Ajahn Brahmani was born in Norway in the year of 1964. So he first became interested in Buddhism and meditation in his early 20s after a visit to Japan. And having completed degrees in engineering and finance, he began his monastic training at Anagarika, keeping the 8 precepts in England at the Amaravati and the Chaitras Buddhist Monastery.
Yes.
And after hearing a talk by Ajahn Brahm, so he decided to travel to Australia to train at the Bodhiana Monastery. And Ajahn has since lived at Bodhiana Monastery since 1994 and was ordained as a bhikkhu with Ajahn Brahm as his preceptor. Now in 1996, Ajahn also, in 1996, he was ordained. And he also teached Pali and Vinaya to the monks and Anagarika at the Bodhiana Monastery. So tonight, Ajahn will share with us on Sutta and meditation. How should we study and practice? So, what's the session for Ajahn?
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me okay, everybody? Yeah, it's fine. Okay, good. So I was very happy when I saw the title of the book, when I saw the title of the talk tonight, because this is exactly the sort of title I like. Buddhism and Sutta and meditation, how it fits together, is exactly the kind of thing that I like to talk about. Because so many people in this world, we have all kinds of teachers, we have this teacher, that teacher, we follow this kind of system of meditation, that kind of system of meditation. But how often have you asked somebody, who is your teacher, who is your meditation teacher? And they reply, the Buddha. How often is that there? It never happens. Everybody says this one or that one. And for that reason, it's actually very important to be able to go back to the suttas and to see what the Buddha himself had to say about this. And I will say, I want to actually point out a few of the things tonight that the Buddha did say about meditation practice and also about the practice of Buddhism in general, which is actually very, very useful advice. And it's right there in the sutta, it's right there for you to see here. And I want to point these things out because it shows you the value of reading the sutta, of understanding it, the word of the Buddha. But before I do that, I just want to say a little bit about how prevalent this thing about having all kinds of teachers is in this world, and you can call it guru worship if you like, but it's so incredibly prevalent. And sometimes, as Theravada Buddhists, we think it's only the Tibetans that do guru worship. And it's true, the Tibetans do have a very strong tradition of guru worship, because that is how the Tibetan tradition works. And in their tradition, you do exactly what the guru says, you get the secret mantra, then you follow the right things on it. But in Theravada, also, the idea of guru worship, of following one particular teacher, actually is very, very powerful and very strong. People are Mahasiddhisiddha disciple, they are Gwenda disciple, they are Ajahn Sumedho disciple, they are disciple of Bhante Ratana, they follow Bhikkhu Bodhi's lectures online. Anything here but the Buddha. You travel to Thailand and you ask a monk in Thailand, well, you know, what do you do? Who is your teacher? What is your practice? And they will point to the abbot of the monastery or some sort of teacher that used to be the abbot of the monastery, and then they say, oh, he's an arahant, I follow his teachings. And after a while you think, everybody must be an arahant in this around here, because so many people are arahants, and everybody's really, you know, has their act together. And of course, we all want our teacher to be good, otherwise we wouldn't choose that teacher in the first place. It's natural psychology that we like to think that our teacher is an arahant. But sometimes this is not reliable. We realize after a while, not everybody is arahants. In fact, the more you know about Buddhism, and the more you know about the state of Buddhism in the world today, the more you realize that actually it's very likely to be very, very few arahants around. These beings are extremely rare. Even finding somebody who understands the Dhamma thoroughly in a deep way is actually very, very rare in the world. Somebody who is an Aryan, somebody who is a stream maker, who understands the Dhamma thoroughly, is very, very difficult to find. And you're very lucky, very fortunate if you have such a teacher. But when you have this faith that Maitre Abbot is an Arahant, then what happens if it isn't? What happens if you're wrong here? And that is where the problem lies. And that's where you have to go back to the word of the Buddha himself and find out what actually the real Buddhist path, the real Buddhist practice is. And I will read you a short little thing from the suttas, because this is what the Buddha himself said 2,500 years ago about how people in the future will start to use the Dhamma in the wrong way. And this is what he said. He called this sutta, it's called future perils. In other words, future dangers. The sort of thing which leads to the decline of Buddhism in the future. And the Buddha said, there are these five future perils. I'll take one of them. As yet unarisen, that will arise in the future. You should recognize them and make an effort to abandon them. What are these five? And of these five, the one that caught my eye in particular when I was reading this, the other ones are also important, but the one that I saw in particular was the following. Again, bhikkhus, in the future, there will be bhikkhus who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata are being recited and are deep, deep in meaning, world-transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They will not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, apply their minds to understand them, and they will think those teachings should be studied and learned. And this is the fourth future peril, as yet unarisen, that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. And this is the state of Buddhism today. This is where we are today. Because basically, the vast majority of people, not only lay people, but monastics, they will have no idea what's in the suttas, no clue what's happening in the suttas, what the Buddha said. And they will follow a teacher here, they will follow a teacher there. The disciples of the Buddha, basically. Everybody around today are disciples of the Buddha, we're all disciples of the Buddha, and we're listening to each other's teachings rather than to the teachings of the Buddha. This is so. The Buddha said it right here. It's very amazing that he can actually predict that, predict the state of affairs in the future. It just shows that this is a natural tendency that tends to happen in society. And that's why the Buddha could foresee these things happening. And what is interesting here is that one of the things that he says is that disciples of the Buddha, are not on the same level as the Buddha himself. In the future, they will listen to disciples rather than the word of the Buddha. And what disciples means is not just everybody who was alive today, but if you go back into history, and you see the various kinds of scriptures that have arisen over the centuries, things like the commentaries, things like various types of ancillary works that exist all over the place, things like the Abhidhamma, all the things that came after the Buddha, all of that is the word of disciples and not the word of the Buddha. And then you can even actually go back to the suttas themselves. And you see in the suttas, there are some discourses spoken by disciples, and the majority spoken by the Buddha. And even within those suttas, you can say that the word of the Buddha must take precedence over the other suttas if there is some disparity or something which doesn't make sense. And in this way, you can sort of find your way, and you can find your way back to the word of the Buddha himself. And it's very important to understand that the sutras that we have today in like the Pali Canon or the Chinese Agamas, even more so in the Pali Canon, because the problem with the Chinese Agamas is that they have been translated and things are always lost in translation. The Pali is much closer, for that reason, to the word of the Buddha. But the point is, we have the word of the Buddha today. That is what is so powerful. Right? And sometimes people think, how do we really know that? And we know, modern research, in my opinion, shows very clearly that what we have is very close, not word for word, but very close to what the Buddha himself taught. And this becomes then very, very important. And it's very important for many reasons. The first reason, as I already mentioned, is that we just don't know people today, are they really enlightened? We think that they're enlightened. We think they know what they're talking about. We have a teacher there, we have a teacher here. They sound very good, they may be very charismatic, and they have a lot of metta, and they have all these wonderful qualities. But sometimes we're still unsure whether they really know what they're talking about. But there is one person, as Buddhists, that we have to have faith in, and that is the Buddha. Why? Because if you hadn't got faith that the Buddha was enlightened, if the Buddha didn't know what he was talking about, there is no Buddhism anymore. All the Buddhism collapses. So that faith has to be there. That confidence that the Buddha knew has to be established. And because everybody else, there's a certain degree of uncertainty about them. You go back to the Buddha, that is where you have to place your final kind of basis of what Buddhism is. And then you can compare what everybody else says to what the Buddha said. That is the first reason. It is like the foundation stone of Buddhism. This must be right. If this isn't right, everything else collapses. So this is the foundation. This is the basis. This is the point of departure for where you decide whether anybody has got the goods, so to speak, whether they know what they're talking about. And the second reason is that the Buddha, his teachings are, generally speaking, more profound and deeper than the teachings of anybody else. First of all, he must have been fully awakened. I prefer awakened to enlightened. He must have been fully awakened, and for that reason, he knew things to the full depth. The second thing is, remember the Buddha, he was one who awakened by himself. Right? Now, we are all striving on this path, and I'm sure you all agree that it's not always easy. It's not easy to reach awakening. I'm sure if I ask for a raising of hands of how many people here are awakened, I don't think I will get that many hands coming up. And this is, it's difficult enough to be a disciple, right? Now the Buddha, he didn't have a teacher, and he went out there and he was able to awaken by himself. And that takes some serious wisdom, to put it that way. He was seriously wise to be able to do that. And that is why you have the most profound teachings are also to be found in the suttas, the most reliable and the most profound. And that is why it is so important to go back to the suttas, not to neglect reading the suttas. And sometimes people say to me, yeah, but I mean, if I go back to the suttas, that means I have to rely on you because you teach me the suttas. And there is some truth to that, because sometimes it is good to have a teacher who guides you into the suttas, who shows you how it can be read, how the profundity of the suttas can be reached, etc. And of course, as long as we are relying on a teacher, there's a certain danger that the teacher will lead us astray. But the good thing is that even though you have a teacher, you also have the suttas, and you can read them by yourself. You can get the opinions of other teachers, you can cross-check, you can start to investigate these things. You have a neutral source that you can check from, which is the suttas themselves. And after a while, when you get skilled at reading the suttas, you open the sutta and you read them, and you find out for the first time in your life, you can actually start to question what other people are saying. You can say, this teacher doesn't make any sense. I don't believe that because the Buddha said something else. Of course, you've got to be a little bit careful about that sort of thing, because sometimes you misunderstand it. But that is what you get when you reach a certain level of confidence. And I'm sure that people like Ajahn Brahm is going to be fed up with having a disciple like me, because I always question him and I say, but Ajahn, this doesn't fit for the suttas, how can you say this? And Ajahn Brahm is usually very patient and he explains and he's saying, you know. But after a while, it's probably a little bit exhausting to be the, you know, teacher of disciples, always questioning you. But I think it's right. I think that's what we have to do. We have to question it. If you have doubts about anything, if you think something is wrong, question it. And if the teacher is a good teacher, they will reply in a good way. They won't dismiss the question, they will reply in a good way and take your question seriously. And hopefully you will gain some insight from that person. So anyway, so that is the foundation. I only want to talk about this briefly here. This is the foundation stone, the suttas. So what happens when you start reading the suttas? What do you see in there? I will give you some ideas, some of the things that I have picked up over the years and seen there, which I think are very important, which make me very happy that I read those suttas. And one of the things that always stood out, which nobody else had taught me when I read the suttas, was the Buddha's idea of how to view your spiritual practice, whether you are going in the right direction or whether you are not going in the right direction there. And the Buddha said that you should always look inside of yourself. You should look inside and see, are your good qualities increasing and are your bad qualities declining? Good qualities, virtue, are you becoming more virtuous? Are you becoming kinder? Do you have more compassion? Do you have more peace in your mind? Do you have more sense of metta? Do you have more patience? All of these qualities, are they becoming, are they increasing or are they declining? If they're declining, oh, you've got to be careful. That's not what we want, right? But if you have the bad qualities, and the bad qualities, again, obviously things like in the opposite of these things, the cravings and the angers and the irritations and the impatience and the conceits and all these other kind of things, they should be declining. And when they are declining, then you know that it's going the right direction. Why is this so important? It's so important because we want to head towards, at the very least, we want to have a good rebirth. And there's no point in having a bad rebirth. Ideally, we want to move towards nirvana. We want to move towards something very profound and beautiful, the ending of all suffering, right? Now, to do that, that's what we have to do. We have to improve in good qualities and decline in bad qualities. Otherwise, you're not moving in the right direction. You're moving away. So this is the whole purpose of the spiritual life, is to improve in good qualities and decline in bad qualities. So look for this. Is your practice working? Is this actually happening inside of you? If it isn't happening inside of you, you have to start questioning it. Why isn't it happening yet? What is going wrong yet? What am I not doing? What can I improve in my life? And you will find that usually when you question like that, and you have to be honest with yourself, brutally honest, you have to look at yourself as you are, not as you wish to be. And when you do that, usually you find it's actually not that difficult to see what the problem is. Usually it's quite a simple thing. It is, perhaps you are still getting too upset about things in life. Perhaps you have too much craving for the wrong kind of things. And then you have to ask yourself, how can I overcome this? How can I reduce this in life? Look inside of yourself and ask, what is the problem? And then you will be moving in the right direction. But not only that, this idea about improving in the good states and declining in the bad states, it is an incredibly good guide for how to live our lives. So I always take myself as an example. And the example that I often have is, when you live in a monastery for a long time, I've lived with Ajahn Brahm for 17 years, sometimes you think, maybe I should be doing something else. Maybe I should go to a different monastery. Perhaps I should have try a different teacher, or perhaps, maybe there is all kind of reasons why you want to change the situation you're in there. But then I remember this word of the Buddha. The word of the Buddha is, if you're improving in the good states and declining in the bad states, then you are in the right place. You have the right teacher there. You're doing the right thing. Continue doing that. And that has been my guidance. It's such a simple guidance. And it's so profound to help you make decisions in life. And you should do exactly the same. Ask yourself, is it improving or is it not improving yet? And then you have this beautiful guide which can help you to make decisions in life. What should I do? Should I get a new job, for example. Now, if all you want to do is to climb the corporate hierarchy and you want to make more money or whatever, then you have to ask yourself, is this going to be at the expense of my spiritual qualities, or is it going to also improve my spiritual qualities? And if you are a Buddhist and you believe in rebirth and you believe in suffering and all the problems in life, you realize you have to have a much broader perspective than just this single life. because of that broader perspective on just this single life, but you remind yourself that actually climbing the corporate hierarchy is going to destroy my spiritual progress. I'm not interested in that. Spiritual progress is more important. If you can combine them, it's great. Some people can combine these things, and certainly there's nothing wrong as such with climbing the corporate ladder or with making lots of money, all that kind of thing. As I said, these are bad things, but be careful that you may keep your priorities in the right order. That is so important. And you can say there's so many things in life. Where should I live? Should I go on a retreat? Should I listen to this talk? Who is my teacher? All these kind of things come down to the same thing. Is it going to lead to an increase in good qualities and a decline in bad qualities? Then that's the one. You've got to go in the right place. So this is how, and it's so good sometimes to have a very simple and clear guide in life, to guide you, to tell you how to make decisions. Because decisions are often so difficult to make and so hard to know what is the right thing to do. So for me, when I read this in the Sutta, it's many, many years ago now since I read it now, and for me it was such an eye-opener, because I never really knew how to make decisions in life. And here was a very, very clear guideline. So that is one example of how you should practice according to the Buddha's teaching. This is a very broad guideline and very broad base. But what then does the Buddha have to say about meditation practice specifically? What is in the suttas that is very useful as a meditation guide? And the first thing that we find in the sutta that is very important is the middle path. And that is the first thing here. You may not think that that is much of a meditation guide, because it's, you know, it's like in between sensuality, halfway between sensuality and the self-mortification. But actually it is a very powerful meditation guide. And the reason for that is because what it means, mortification of the body, means tormenting the body. Now when I look around the world, when I see people practicing Buddhism on meditation retreats, all over the place basically, you find that people have a tendency to sit with far too much pain in the body. And this is tormenting the body. The Buddha says in the middle way, this is the wrong path. So straight away, you know that if you're sitting with lots of pain, it is actually not right. And I remember a few years ago when I was giving some teaching in Singapore, I was living in a flat with a man who actually, I think he was from KL, but he was working in Singapore and coming back to KL on the weekends. And he told me that he had been on a retreat with somebody, I'm not sure who it was, and he said it had been so terrible, he had been so uptight and so terrible, he never ever in his whole life did he want to go on a retreat ever again. And I thought, what a shame, I thought that was a terrible thing. I said to him, not all retreats are the same, you know, some retreats are more relaxing, you know, the teachers aren't always the same, why don't you try something else? But he was adamant, he was never ever going to go on a retreat again. And I've never seen that man again, so maybe he was, you know, making good on his promise not to go on retreats, or maybe stop going to talks and everything, and he might be Christian, I don't know. But this is terrible, isn't it? It's so bad, because this is not what Buddhism is about. It's not about torturing yourself to the point where you want to give up Buddhism. It's about, Buddhism is about happiness, it's about finding joy inside, finding kindness inside, finding all these good qualities. And here we're going in the wrong way. So make sure that you don't torture yourself when you go on retreats. Make sure you're comfortable. Sit on a chair if you want to. One of the things I was noticing quite recently in the suttas, when you read the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta of Mindfulness of Breathing, it starts off with saying you sit down cross-legged. But then I was reading in a sutta recently that was about a nun who was ill, and she was saying to the Buddha, "Oh, the only time I feel comfortable is when I sit cross-legged." And then I realized, well, the reason why you sit cross-legged is because it's a comfortable position. So for people who have grown up sitting on the floor, like some people in Thailand, like we did in ancient India, this is a natural position. This is how they're comfortable. So when it says sit down cross-legged, what it means is sit comfortably. That's what it actually means. So there's no magic for sitting cross-legged. It actually means sit comfortably. So if you are more comfortable in some other position, then use that instead. Use enough cushions to be comfortable, sit on a chair, use one of the meditation stools that are available, whatever makes you comfortable. And if on the retreat you have pain in your legs, pain in your back, don't don't wait long before you change your posture. Don't wait long. If it sort of recurs and your mind tends to go back to the pain again, that shows you the pain is too much. You need to change your posture now. So don't wait long for that. And then you can enjoy the meditation so much more. You don't get so upset and angry. You know, it's like if you have too much pain, you can't have any happiness when that happens. You feel upset, you feel negative, you feel, oh, you know, all these kind of things. It's terrible. So make sure that you don't do that, because it just destroys the whole purpose of meditation practice. So that is one simple teaching in the suttas, the middle way. Don't torture, don't torment the body. And you see this in many places, the Buddha talks about this. Don't do that. And be careful. Sometimes you hear about the great Ajahn in Thailand who sit with incredible pain and then they sort of go through the pain. And it's true. Sometimes some people may have some success with using pain as a meditation object. But there's two things to remember. First of all, some of these teachers were incredibly good meditators. And it doesn't mean that you should follow and do exactly what they did. But secondly, and even more importantly, is that no matter how painless they were, no matter how good they were, even if they were arahats, the Buddha said, that is not the path. So even if they did it that way, and even if they had success that way, the fact that the Buddha said the meditation happens otherwise means you should not pursue that path just because that monk or that nun or that layperson happened to have success that way. And in a way, you don't even know if they really had success. You don't actually know how far they were on the path. So be careful. Choose your inspiration wisely on the Buddha's path. So this is the first thing the Buddha says. Another thing the Buddha says about meditation practice is to use wisdom rather than willpower. And this is very much in line with Ajahn Brahm. Those of you who know Ajahn Brahm, he says wisdom, power, not willpower. And again, to me, I'd like to test Ajahn Brahm, so I'd like to read the suttas. And when I see that what he says is in accordance with the suttas, it just confirms to me that I have the right teacher. And if it doesn't confirm what it says, well, then I have to question him about it. But in this sense, it confirms very well how Ajahn Brahm teaches it. And sometimes you read the suttas, it talks about overcoming unwholesome states. And it uses sometimes very powerful vocabulary. It says things like you obliterate, you do away, you crush these negative states of mind. That's often the words, how it's translated into English. And sometimes you have to be careful with these translations, because sometimes you don't know exactly what these things mean in the Pali language. And when you read what the Buddha meant by obliterating, by doing away with, by subduing these negative states, and this is from the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of unwholesome thoughts, this is what I'm going to be teaching on this weekend as well. I'm going to be repeating myself a little bit probably, but that's okay. He says in there that the way to overcome these negative states is through reflecting on the danger in these states, by seeing that they lead away from wisdom, by seeing that they are uncomfortable. That is how you obliterate these states. You don't use willpower. You don't clench your teeth and you press the tongue against the root palate, as it says elsewhere in the suttas. That's not the way you do it. You do it through wisdom, by asking yourself, how is it that these things are dangerous? How is it that they lead the wrong way and they go the wrong way? And then what happens is that they disappear like that. If you really have insight, you really understand that, they disappear like that. And that is what I think the Buddha means by obliterating and by abandoning and doing away with it, is that once you reflect in the right way, the hindrances disappear very, very quickly indeed. So this is the path. The path then is the path of wisdom. It's a path of reflecting, of understanding the danger, understanding the suffering that you're causing for yourself, that you're causing for other people in the future. And because you're causing suffering here, and you're moving away from wisdom, it says panya nirodhika, ceases wisdom, it eliminates wisdom. That is why you abandon these things, and that is why you move on the spiritual path. So wisdom power, no willpower. That is the second thing you see. Another thing you see is that you see the importance of the place of mindfulness on the Buddhist path. And one of the things that I see all the time when I read the suttas is that mindfulness always has to be established before you really can meditate properly. And you see that when you read the Satipatthana Sutta, which obviously is about meditation practice, it says in the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, it says Satyama. Satyama means having mindfulness. In other words, you have to have the mindfulness established before Satipatthana can even begin. You read the Anapanasati Sutta, which is one of the other big suttas on meditation practice. Again, it says, having established mindfulness, sati parimukkhange upasamhetva is the Pali, if I remember correctly. It means having established mindfulness in front of you. Again, that is the beginning of a sutta. That is what you have to actually be able to do meditation practice. Why is it? It's just interesting to reflect, why is it that you have to have sati in the beginning? And the reason is because mindfulness is considered a power and a faculty in the suttas. It is a power and a faculty in the sense that when you have this aspect of the mind established, then you are in charge of the mind. The mind doesn't run all over the place anymore. It's not the defilements that are in charge. You are in charge. You feel a sense of power inside of you. You feel a sense of being in charge of your own practice, your own body and mind. You can direct your mind wherever you want. That is what faculty means, what the power means. These are the indriyas, right, and the balas in the Pali canon. So you have to have that ability to control your mind before you can start meditation. It makes sense, right? Because meditation is about focusing on an object. And how can you focus on an object if your mind is going all over the place? You can't. So you have to have that sense of power inside of you, of ability of the mind to stick on a certain object. And that is what indriya actually means. So, and this is one of the problems, you find that the vast majority of meditators, they sit down and they start watching the breath, or they start doing all kinds of contemplations and things, but they haven't actually established mindfulness yet. But so you understand that the first thing I have to do is to establish mindfulness, and then can I start my meditation practice properly. So when you sit down and you close your eyes, you review yourself and you find out, do I have enough mindfulness? Do I have clarity of mind? Am I in the present moment? Or am I drifting off? Have I got some defilements coming? Am I irritated with somebody? Have I got some desire in the mind? All these kind of things. If you haven't got the clarity, if you have some desire or defilement, you have to overcome that first of all. And only then can your meditation practice really start. So then, of course, that leads us to the other topic, which the suttas are very good. Again, to find out how meditation is practiced according to the suttas, and that is, well, how do we become mindful? What are the causes for mindfulness? How does mindfulness get established in the first place? And one of the fascinating things that I sometimes read about all this research that's being done, in particularly in the US, where they research the power of mindfulness to be able to overcome problems in life, and they look at the aspects of mindfulness, how it is defined and what it means to you and all these kind of things. But there's one thing always missing from this research, and that is what causes mindfulness in the first place. And the reason that is missing, I think, is because they don't know what that is. They don't understand what that is. All they know is that mindfulness is good, but they haven't really understood why it is. And in the vast majority, I think, of these cases, they think that it's just a matter of willing it into existence. By willing mindfulness into existence, by saying, I will be mindful, I will be present, by doing that, you actually will give rise to mindfulness. And it's true, you can give rise to some mindfulness through willpower, because you can suppress the mind a little bit if it's moving too much this way and that way. But of course, what happens if you use the willpower to become mindful? After a while, the mind starts to rebel, because it doesn't want to be suppressed. After a while, when the mind rebels, it gets restless. Or, if you use too much willpower, it might get tired because of the willpower. So after a while, it doesn't work. So there is only one way to establish real mindfulness, and that is to allow it to arise by itself. So if you're going to do the breath meditation, you have to wait till the mindfulness arises. And then the breath comes into vision by itself. Suddenly you're aware of the breath. And then when you are aware of the breath, a as a natural object that arises by itself, that is the right time to watch the breath. Not really watch it, but it's like you're placing your attention on the breath there. You're not really using any willpower, just placing your attention there. Then it goes away, and then it comes back again. And that is how you do it. So how then does mindfulness get established at all? What are the causal factors? And of course, this is the power of Buddhism. This is the power of the Buddhist path. We talked about causality. You know, everything has a cause. So what is the cause that leads to the effect of mindfulness? And again, if you read the suttas carefully, you see that the cause is always the purity of the mind. It's the purity of the mind, purity of a person, that leads to mindfulness. So if your mindfulness isn't strong enough yet, it is because there is still some impurity inside of you that you haven't abandoned. Again, when you read sutta like the Dvaita, the two kinds of thought sutta in the Majjhimanikaya, it's very explicit. It shows the Buddha, he divides his thinking into two parts, good thinking, bad thinking. Then he abandons the bad thinking. And then, when he has abandoned the bad thinking, he also stops the good thinking. And then he is mindful. That is how mindfulness gets established. So then you know, okay, I want to be more mindful on my next retreat. What do I have to do? I have to purify myself in daily life. I have to make sure that I understand the danger in anger, the danger in harm, the danger even in coarse forms of craving, the circling in anger. And I have to actually try to do my very best to overcome these things. And then, if you are successful with that, you will find that on every retreat, year by year, your mindfulness is better on that retreat because you have purified yourself. And in the long run, this is the only way you're going to be successful in meditation, on retreats, is by the degree to which you purify yourself in daily life. Once you're on the retreat, there's only so much you can do because you take all the baggage from your ordinary life with you to the retreat. So if you haven't been careful in ordinary life, you're only going to go so far on the retreat. And of course, for me as a monk, these things are very, very important because my whole life revolves around these things. So that's why I get also very inspired when I see these kind of things in the suttas. And the last thing in the sutta that I perhaps should mention a little bit is about what about meditation in daily life? And the meditation in daily life, again, that the Buddha talks about, the most important aspect is just to be kind, to be gentle, to be good, to have a sense of metta and compassion. So, metta and compassion starts with actions, it starts with speech. So you are kind in speech, you are kind in action. And then, whatever meditation you do, make sure that supports your metta in daily life. It supports your compassion in daily life, your ability to be kind, your ability to be good. That, I think, is the best kind of meditation for daily life. What you're doing there is you're doing these things the Buddha was talking about. You're changing your perception of the world, changing your perception of people around you. That is what your meditation consists of. By doing metta, by reminding yourself of the goodness of people around you, by forgiving the bad qualities, and from your heart, wishing them well, may you be well. By doing that, you're changing your perceptions. By changing your perceptions, you're purifying yourself. And when you're purifying yourself, your virtue improves, you get more mindfulness, and the next retreat will take off and become much, much more powerful. So, there you are. So these are some of the things that you can glean, see in the sutta, why the suttas are so powerful and why they can be so helpful. So, I think that I have probably said plenty enough for this evening. So, should we have some questions? I think, yeah, okay. Yeah. So, do you have any questions then? Do you have any complaints? Please contradict me, this is your chance. Say the sutta says this, why are you saying that? You shouldn't be saying that. You're allowed to contradict me. This is part of the this is a bad. So, does anybody here read the sutras? Yeah, okay, good. more questions then? Okay. It's very, yes, please, sir. Okay.
You mentioned that sit has happy before you sit, and I think you actually heard you say that when you're going through a lot of emotions, you're going to have problems and so forth, that that's not the best time to actually do your meditation. Am I correct when I heard that? Because it's like, I see like most of us, or I would like, if I have something that's causing me, I'll just sit quietly. Would that be no mindfulness before I
answer? I think what I'm saying, thank you for bringing that up, I think it's a very important point, is that what I'm really saying is that meditation proper, when I'm by meditation proper, I mean like watching the brain. So the real meditation, which is actually the one which leads to very deep states of samadhi, whatever, that only begins when mindfulness is there. But of course, you know, there are times when you feel maybe emotional, and you just want to calm down, and you just want to be peaceful, and you just want to feel good. And that is kind of, it's meditation, but it's not really the, you know, the meditation they talked about in the suttas, because actually, the meditation in the suttas is a very high level of meditation. If you really do satipatthana and anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath properly, is actually very profound. But that doesn't mean that kind of lesser, call it lesser without being disparaging, lesser kind of meditation is bad, it's also good. So if you can just sit down and close your eyes, and just close your eyes and just relax, and you feel your mind calms down, you become more peaceful, wonderful, that is great. And then when you come out afterwards, you feel better about yourself, that will support your virtue and your whatever it is in life. I know even Ajahn Brahm, when he has had a busy, and he is really a master of meditation, and he, when he has had a busy day, and he just often sits back, and he doesn't sit with his breath back, he leans against the wall. So you two lean against the wall if you feel tired. It's not wrong to lean against the wall. So lean against the wall, then just relax. If you try to sit straight when the mind is all over the place, you're not even ready for sitting straight. You shouldn't be sitting straight. You need to relax at that point. So sit back and relax. And then, if you find that your mind becomes clear, mindfulness arises, then you can sit straight. Because then you feel it's natural to sit straight. You want to sit straight because your mind is clear there. But when you sit, just relax and you're calming down, lean back and enjoy yourself. So, okay? Yeah. So, yeah. Yes, thank you.
A person were to do metta meditation, how do you integrate mindfulness with
metta meditation? Okay. Well, ideally, metta is also a metta properly done is a very, very high kind of meditation. It's very, very profound. And well, I mean, if you read, look at the suttas again, and you look at where metta fits in on the path, usually it comes after the jhanas. Have you noticed that? Often you have the four jhanas, and then you have the four Brahma Viharas after that, including metta meditation. So basically, metta is usually something that you do based on profound samadhi. That is the ideal kind of metta. So, and of course, again, if you have mindfulness, metta will be much more powerful. But sometimes you can't wait for these things. Sometimes you have to do metta in your own way. And this may not be the metta meditation the Buddha talked about in the suttas, which is pervaded in the four directions with metta or whatever. It may just be your own personal way of practicing goodness towards other people. You know, you sit down. Even if you haven't, it's good to give rise to as much mindfulness as possible before you start off. So sit back, relax, allow the mind to become peaceful. So as much mindfulness as you can get on that particular day. So always relax first, and then do 5, 10, 15 minutes, how much time you have of metta meditation. You can do it in different ways. But the main thing in the early stages is to learn to change your perception, to see beings differently. It's not about pervading the whole world with metta, because you can't do that. It takes a very, very long time. But what you can learn is you can learn to look at people differently. So, you know, bring up the image of somebody. That's why we say when we do metta, bring up the image of somebody smiling, somebody happy. Remind yourself of the good qualities. One of the problems with anger in the world, and with anger, is that we tend to focus sometimes on the very insignificant, tiny little things that happen in daily life. We tend to get bogged down in you know, the petty things of life, the small things that don't really matter. And because we get bogged down in the small things that don't really matter, we miss out on the metta. So the metta then is to develop the big picture. It's to remind yourself that this person that you're getting upset with or angry with, actually, they have lots of tremendous good qualities. They're following the five precepts. They're trying to be good in this world. They're trying to practice in the right way. Their intentions are pure. They're trying to do the right thing. Of course they're not going to be perfect. But when you look at the big picture, you see something beautiful there. And it's easy to forgive somebody who does the right thing in the big picture. And this is how you do metta meditation. You sit down, remind yourself of the big picture, see them with a smile on the face, and then say from your heart, may you be well, may you be happy here. May things go well for you, man. And you wish them well. And then, what you're doing there, you're changing your perception, man. And you're moving away from negative states of mind, improving your wholesome states of mind. The more mindfulness you have, the more powerful that is going to be. But don't wait to perfect mindfulness or anything else before you do these things. Does that make sense? Yeah? Good. Yeah. Please ask stupid questions. Stupid questions are usually really good ones. Not be afraid of stupid questions. I always find, often in the audience, you always find that everybody's thinking but roughly the same thing, but nobody really sure about this question is good enough to be asked, so they're frightened to say anything. Please don't be frightened. Stupid questions are perfectly okay. Some of you will think it's stupid anyway. It's probably a very good one, yeah. You can ask about anything for that matter. If you have anything else on your mind, I'm very happy to try to answer anything you think of. Yes?
Between
Vipassana
and
meditation,
like Vipassana meditation, what are the difference between these two meditations?
Between Vipassana and meditation? Okay, well, the difference really is that Vipassana really, they often talk about Vipassana meditation, but there is actually no such thing in the suttas. The Buddha never used the word Vipassana meditation. He used the word Vipassana, and he used the word Samatha, and these two are calm and insight. Actually, even insight is not such a good translation, I think, for Vipassana. More like seeing things clearly or something like that. So the Buddha just talked about meditation. And meditation has two aspects. Clear seeing, which is Vipassana, and calm, which is Samatha. These are the two aspects of meditation. And if you do the meditation properly, both of these things will tend to grow together. And that's why the suttas always talks about Samatha Vipassana. Together, it's a compound. It's actually one word. It's not even two words. It's one word together. It's called a Dvanda compound in Pali. It means that it's a twin compound. They go together. That is how you always find it in the suttas. So anything you do which leads to calm, which leads to Vipassana, that is the right way. Yeah. So Vipassana is not like an outcome. How do you get Vipassana? How do you get calm? Practicing Anapanasati. Practicing Brahmavihara, practicing Metta, gives rise to these things. So of course, when people talk about Vipassana meditation, very often what they mean sitting down, and they can like watching the feelings in the body, this kind of things. But really, whatever meditation you do, it's about two things, insight and calm. And the two things always go together. So it's a difference in the focus, and the focus of the Brahmavihara is just focus on kindness, focus on being kind, being good. And I would recommend that very, very highly. The Buddha talked about metta meditation so often in the suttas. He says it's very, very important. And it is so important precisely because it purifies your mind. And when your mind is purified, then you get mindfulness. And only when you have mindfulness can Vipassana and Samatha really start to happen. Before you have mindfulness, nothing really works. When mindfulness comes, that is when things really start. So do metta meditation. I think that is one of the most important things to do there. That will give you so much support on your spiritual aspirations and on the path. So do that. That's what I recommend anyway. I'm sure many other people will say different things. That's the problem in life. Everybody says different things. Everybody is so confused and don't know what to do. So go back to the word of the Buddha. So if you see the Buddha says, do metta, okay, I'll trust that one.
I was told metta is much easier, Vipassana
is much tougher.
So do the tough one,
because
then when you do metta, it will be very easy.
Okay. Well, the reality is that, it's not meditation is about having mindfulness, first of all. If you haven't got mindfulness, you can't do meditation. So first of all, do those things that give rise to mindfulness, which is to purify yourself. So I say metta comes first. Then. And if metta is easy, don't start with the hard things. Start with the easier things. Then. You know, I think it's silly to start with the hard things. Start with the easy things. That makes life, you know, flow much more easily for you, man, and you actually have a good time. If you start with the hard things, you end up giving up sometimes. Is anyone here, Drew? Oops, ghosts. Is anybody here doing breath meditation? Anapanasana meditation? Yeah? Does it work? Yeah? Sometimes, yeah? It's always going to be like that, but sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. That's just the name of the game. Yes? Yeah.
You
don't
quite get the meaning, and then when you try to reread
it
again,
still get the meaning. Yeah, it's true. And first of all, of course, is to understand the importance of reading the sutta. That's the first motivation factor. Understand that the actual reading title is there. How do you decide which teacher talks the real thing, which one doesn't? You don't know. Go to the sutta. This is the final decision maker for what is Buddhism. Everything else is uncertain. If this is uncertain, nothing is certain. So this is where you have to go. And when you understand how important it is, and why do you want to go and listen to another talk by another monk? Okay, sometimes you do that because it's inspiring. Sometimes the living example is inspiring. You get a monk who's very impressive, or a nun, a lay person who's very impressive. They have the Dhamma in their heart, and you can feel it. Of course, that is very powerful. And you should go to those kind of talks, because it makes the Dhamma come alive. But remember that actually, to understand what is really going on, the word of the Buddha is what matters. Sometimes the most inspiring person may not actually understand what they're doing about. Some people just have a natural stage presence. They have a power, a natural charisma. You find that in all kind of ordinary people sometimes. That is not what we're looking for. We're looking for something really profound. So remember that it actually is important. Number one. Number two, find yourself a teacher, or many teachers who teach the sutras in a way that you can understand and relate to. Take somebody who has a good reputation, and you have somebody like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, has a very good reputation. You mentioned it before when I spoke to you before. Very good reputation. And everybody knows he has translated so many sutras. He's been a monk for 40 years or whatever. He sells his books to the most reputable of the Buddhist publication societies around the world. So he is, if anybody is good, he is good. So go into something like that and listen to what they have to say about the sutras. If you think Adam Ram knows it, listen to Adam Ram's teaching about the sutras. I too give sutra readings, but I'm a bit of a kind of whippersnapper compared to some of these other monks. But you know, you can listen to my teachings as well. I think they're quite good. you may disagree, but I think that they're okay. Yeah. So listen to those teachings. And then compare them, and people will say different things. And gradually you come to understand it. And yes, you are still dependent on the teacher, but gradually you move towards independence. And that is where you want to get. You want to get to the point where you're independent, where you say, now I can read these things for myself. And another thing, which is a great motivation factor, is that start teaching others. So if you are somebody who knows the suit as well, come here and teach others. You learn so fast when you teach others. You come up here, you don't know what you're talking about. It's not very nice. So you learn very fast. Then, when you read the suttas, with in mind the fact that you're going to teach others about it, you read the sutta in an entirely different way. Because now you focus. Every word suddenly becomes important, and you think about it in a new way. So do teach others. I know Ajahn Shah said that. He said that the best way to learn the Dhamma is to teach others. Because you have to know what you're talking about. So try some of those ways. And read the suttas that you like. Don't force yourself, don't just read like mechanically one sutta after the other. if one sutta is boring, skip anything and go to something else. You know, do something that you enjoy, something that inspires you. Don't, and eventually you come back to the boring sutta and you find actually it wasn't that boring after all. It was just your perception at the time, right? That's how it goes. Victor, do you want to say anything?
Yes, Achyanda, I was wondering that if you want to start studying the sutras, is there a recommended way on how best to approach it? Because there are many different collections of the sutras.
Yeah.
Do you want to start from page one for right through?
Yeah.
And there are also, sometimes you have selections, you know, sutras that actually put together some sutras.
Yeah.
What's the best way that when we go through the sutra study, then there is always some kind of improvement?
Yeah, sure. I think a very good way of doing it is to take one of the anthologies that are available these days, which are, an author or a translator has picked out the sutra and put them together in a systematic way, sutra that he thinks are important. And of course, the classic one these days is in the Buddha's Word by Vitti Bodhi again. He has taken it out, he has made an anthology of what he reckons are the sutras that cover broadly what the Dhamma is about, has classified it, put it into a nice sequence so that they all make sense in a certain order. And then he has given introductions, and he explained what's going on, and then notes at the end. That is a wonderful way of reading the suttas, because then it makes sense, it comes together. Sometimes when you get this enormous collection in front of you and you start reading it, you don't understand how it fits together, because it's just too much information to begin with. So get one of those anthologies. Beautiful. Vitti Bodhi is, in my opinion, a very reliable translator. He doesn't get everything right. Nobody gets everything right. But generally speaking, he's very reliable and very good. And then once you have that, then you can progress. You can actually take the Majjhimanikaya, which is a beautiful collection, read it for yourself. Then you can take the Anguttaranikaya. Anguttaranikaya is coming out soon, being published by Wisdom Publications, translation by Vitti Bodhi again. It's a wonderful collection, lots of nice little sutras, inspiring things. Things that are important in practice, etc. And gradually you move on like that. And then you can have you are an expert in the sutras, we do. I know that you probably know more about the sutras than I do. But sometimes I meet lay people who know so much about the sutra that feel, gee, I'm really going to get my act together now. So it's good actually to have that. So, teach the sutras here, teach the sutras and then. Have people ask questions, get everybody to read the sutta beforehand, come here, ask questions, and discuss these things. Because I'm sure that there are people here, I think you probably have a very good understanding, I'm sure my pen has a very good understanding, I don't know about anybody else, I'm sure that there are probably many people here, do this sort of thing, and then you can invite a monk, if there's somebody who you have trust in, and have a discussion with them as well, or whatever. Gradually, because I'm But also the other thing, of course, is that I realize that lay life is different from monastic life. But monastic life, you have more time to do this kind of thing. So lay life, you have to be more careful in how you spend your time. And don't become the kind of person who just reads the suttas and doesn't practice. But that is also very unfortunate. You have to make sure you actually put these teachings into effect in your life. Otherwise, there's no point.
You mentioned about putting in practice, and just mentioned about only when the mindfulness arises, the practice gets deeper. So what is a good sign that you actually have the right kind of mindfulness?
Basically, you have to learn a lot about that as you go along. But basically, the mindfulness is when you sit down, you close your eyes, and you don't have a lot of thoughts going on. You are in the present moment, your mind is right here, right now. And the mind is quite clear. The mind is not confused or fogged or anything like that. It's clear and it's in the present moment. That's when you know that you have mindfulness. But again, there are many different levels of mindfulness. So to know exactly how much mindfulness you need, this is like there is no absolute quantity in it. But you just test it. So you think, oh, this feels about right, by the mindfulness. Well, let me try to do the mindfulness on the breath then. And you find it doesn't work at all. Okay, it wasn't enough mindfulness. So you know, you try more on it. And then you increase your mindfulness until you get to the point where you can actually watch the breath easily. But the way to watch the breath, and this is really the tricky aspect, is that ideally you don't want to push your mind onto the breath. Ideally what you do is you relax. And you just enjoy the peace, right? Enjoying the peace is like being here and now, because enjoying the peace of the present moment. If you really enjoy the peace of the present moment, then your mindfulness is actually there. And then the breath is suddenly there. You see the breath, because the breath is one thing which is in the present moment, right? And it's quite prominent because it's part of your physical body. And then when your breath is there, then you rest your attention on the breath. You don't put it on the breath, you rest it on the breath. So your attention is resting on the breath. It means there's no will, right? There's no power, there's no force behind it. It's just resting on the breath. It's completely at ease, completely relaxed. Because you're resting, it means that quickly a thought comes, it disappears again. You're not holding on to it. So disappear very quickly. That's fine. It's a good sign. And then you don't force the mind back onto the breath again. What you do, you just wait till the breath reappears again. And then you rest your mind, your mindfulness on the breath, the awareness of the breath. So that is how you know the mindfulness is enough. You don't have to use any force. It happens by itself automatically. Then you know it's right. And you will find that in daily life, it's often very difficult. It's very hard. And that's why I said that in daily life, if you can do it, it's wonderful. Please, by all means, do it if you can do it. But don't feel disappointed if you can't do it in daily life. Because it is, daily life is too much turmoil very often. Too many things happening here. Too busy, too many things to do. So use rather a little bit of meditation just to improve your purity. That's why I say do metta meditation. Change your view of people around you. Change the way you look at things. And then you purify yourself and you're establishing the causes for mindfulness in the future. Next time you go on retreat, you sit back and you think, wow, things have changed. And then you know you're on the right path. This goes back to what I said at the beginning, right? Things are changing. They're going in the right direction. You know something is happening there. It's going the right way. You practice the Buddha's right here. Yes, sir.
Yes, Ajahn. I want to ask, when we make a sutta, should we also make a commentary?
Well, the thing is that, you know, when I teach the sutta, that is a commentary, right? When Ajahn Ram teaches the sutta, and Bhikkhu Bodhi teaches, that is a commentary on the sutta. So you always, in a sense, listen to commentaries. When you read the sutta, you listen to your own commentaries, because you are also interpreting as you go along. So there's always a commentary. So the official commentary is another commentary. And yes, sometimes the official commentary can be useful. There is good stuff in there. I mean, remember that these commentaries were written by very erudite people who really knew the Pali language and understood what was going on. And a lot of what they're saying is very, very useful. But remember, just like I am fallible, just like Bhikkhu Bodhi is fallible, just like you are fallible when you read the sutras, so the commentaries are fallible. I was discussing, because Lai Peng Alvin picked me up at the airport, and I was discussing with them about the commentaries. And one of the commentaries, it says that the Buddha was 18 foot tall, right? Now, when you read the suttas, it is quite clear that he wasn't 18 foot tall, because there are statements which contradict that very clearly. And that shows you the commentaries are fallible, just like anybody else. And there are many places where the commentaries are fallible. So yes, you can read the commentaries, but you know that this is not going to be the final word. Anyway, it's actually very hard to read the commentaries, because the commentaries are mostly only available in the Pali language. So first of all, you have to learn Pali, and then you can learn the commentaries. The other way is that sometimes in translation, they will quote the commentaries in the footnote to tell you how the commentary explains these things. That's what Bhikkhu Bodhi does, for example. So, take it seriously, but know that it's not infallible. And then you are thinking you're doing the right thing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everybody happy then? Yeah. Okay, good then. It's nice to be happy now. There's nothing wrong with being happy now. Yes?
Is meditation a prerequisite for enlightenment?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It is. The reason is because I actually like the word awakening rather than enlightenment, because the word bodhi, which is enlightenment in Pali, or which is the highest state of arahantship in Pali, actually means to be awake. In many European languages, you don't probably know that the European languages are actually connected with the Indian languages. They come from the same root. It's called the Indo-European language group. And because of that, many European words in many different European languages are similar to Indian words. And the word Buddha exists in many European languages to this day, and it means awake, just as you would expect. Particularly in some of the Slavic, the Eastern European languages, the word Buddha actually means awake. But anyway, I'm not really answering your question, but I'm just sort of making my case for why awakening, I think, is preferable to enlightenment. To me, it also means more. Awakening, to me, is more beautiful than enlightenment. I think that's one meaning to it. But anyway, yes, it is absolutely required to meditate to reach awakening. And the reason is because the mind has to be very, very powerful to be able to penetrate so deeply. And that power can only be achieved through meditation practice. And the point is here, you still the mind down, you calm the mind down. In ordinary life, we use our mind all the time. We are restless, we are tired, because we use our mind so much. When you still the mind down, the opposite happens. Because you're not using your mind, because the mind is still, it gets energetic, it gets incredibly powerful. The deeper your meditation is, the more powerful the mind is. And it is that power of the mind that you can use to attain awakening. And it's impossible, I think, to understand. And I'm not really the best person talking about this. Talk to Ajahn Brahm. Talk to somebody who's a very good meditator. And they will tell you that the power that the mind can have in very deep states of meditation is absolutely, he says, like a nuclear reactor, that's what I've said sometimes. It's so powerful that you don't know how to contain it all, you know? And that power, not only powerful, but one-pointed. You can focus on one thing absolutely. Remember that Sati and Samadhi are both called indriyas, faculties. They're both called balas. These are powers of the mind. They are powers because you have a sense of control over your mind at this point. You can now use your mind in exactly the way you want. The mind is, as I said, is malleable. It is wieldy. It is workable. It is soft. You can focus it wherever you want, basically. The mind is so powerful. And that's why, at that point, if you start to recollect the past, you can, according to the suttas, recall your past lives. Try to recall your past life in an ordinary state of mind. You get nowhere there. If you can't even recall what you did this morning, how can you recall the past life? So, and this is the thing, that the mind allows you to recall things that otherwise you would never be able to recall them. And this power, that's why meditation is so important. Meditation, the word for meditation, was usually translated from the Pali, is the word jayanti. The word jayanti is the same word, is the verbal form of jhana. Jhana is the deep state of meditation. Jayanti is how the word actually, what you're doing, is said to be in the suttas. In the English, it's often translated with meditation. I would say it should better be translated as practicing jhana, because it is the same word as jhana. So that is what meditation ultimately means, attaining these very, very powerful states of mind. And then you can do things like awakening, enlightenment, bodhi, supreme happiness, and no more suffering. It sounds worthwhile, doesn't it? So. Anybody else want to ask anything? Last chance, don't miss the opportunity. Yes.
Yes. When will we know we have achieved awakening, if it is possible for the attainment?
To achieve what?
Awakening.
Awakening, yeah. How do you know you achieve awakening, yeah? Okay.
If it is possible for the people like this.
Yeah, well, I think it's possible to get very far on the path. Awakening has many different levels to it, according to the suttas. And Buddha says the first three, what he says is the first three awakenings can be attained by lay people. The fourth one can also be achieved by lay people, but once you achieve that, you are basically a monk or a nun. Because you have, it means that you have given up the household life. So even though you have still kind of lay clothes on or whatever, you have already become, inside, you have become a monk or a nun. You can never go back and live in a house again, basically. So it can be achieved, but it means that you have forsaken all that. So yes, it can be, yeah, it can be done. There was something more to your question, wasn't there?
How do we know, of course. And you mentioned that
yeah.
too many levels, what are the levels?
Yeah, so how do you know that you have become fully awakened? Is that you know that rebirth has come to an end. This is what the arahant, the fully awakened person knows. There's no more rebirth in the future. And that this is the knowledge you have, the knowledge you attain inside of yourself when awakening happens. So if you know inside of yourself, okay, I have no more rebirth, you know you're awakened. Okay, you don't know that, right? Most people don't know that. It's not a kind of ordinary thing. That is how you know that you've reached full awakening. But the lower stages, the first stage of awakening is called stream entry. Stream entry, entering the stream. And the reason why it's called entering the stream is because once you get to that point, there is no return anymore. You have to reach awakening eventually. You enter the stream of the Dhamma, and that stream of the Dhamma will take you all the way to full awakening, to the ending of all rebirth. And how do you know that you've attained that stream entry? It's not always easy. It's not easy to know. But basically, what you have given up is the self-view, the idea that there is an I inside of you. So you've understood that the Buddha's teaching of non-self. That is how you know. But it's actually quite difficult to know, because sometimes people think that they have understood non-self, and they think that they are stream entry, but they haven't actually understood it. Because it's very profound to understand non-self. It's very deep. You have to understand that all aspects of existence are non-self. It's very hard to do that. So you have to be very careful not to overestimate yourself. The world is full of overestimation. There's overestimation everywhere. Everybody goes through that. And so that's why you have to be careful in a certain respect. And one of the signs that you have reached the entry is that meditation, everything becomes so easy afterwards. Because now you have abandoned the idea of the self. You have abandoned the biggest obstacle for meditation practice. So if you get very peaceful, very easily, you enter deep states of samadhi all the time, that is one of the signs that you have attained stream entry. Level 2. Level 2 is called once returning. Somebody who returns once. So what do you think you return to once? What you return to once is, according to Zen, you return once to the world in the sensual realm. That's what you return to once. The way that the kind of the world is explained by the Buddha is that it can be reborn in many different places. One of the places called the sensual realm. The human beings are part of the sensual realm, but it's much more than that. So you get reborn once more in the sensual realm, and then you're finished with the sensual realm, then you become awakened eventually. That is the once returner. Then there is the anagami, the non-returner. The non-returner does not get reborn in the sensual realm, he gets reborn in the fine material realm. So these are the realms that are equivalent to the jhanas, the very deep states of meditation. So you get reborn there, and then you hang out there until you get to the full awakening, and then you are finished with everything. So, yes. Yes. Okay, well, first of all, there weren't any books in those days. This was before there was any printing, any writing of things. So there wasn't any possibility of writing things down. And anyway, even after the Buddha, even when writing started to exist, it was only used in very specific fields. It wasn't actually used for religious books. So it was transmitted orally in the beginning. So the first 300-400 years, it was transmitted just orally, nothing was written down. And the writing down started around 100 years BC. That's when it started to get written down. and the different eras assigned to the different time zone. But the Pali scriptures, people reckon around the first century BC, the writing started to come down. But in the beginning, it was like a mixture of oral transmission and written transmission. And eventually, the written transmission became the most important one. Then. So that is so the Buddha actually did lay these things down. He said, these are the suttas, remember these suttas, this is the basis for the holy life. It is the Dhamma and the Vinaya that I have taught you, which is the basis for your practice after I pass away. Then. Some monks say, oh, please, you know, appoint an heir to the Dhamma, appoint somebody else that we can follow. But I said, no, there's nobody else. It's the Dhamma and the Vinaya. This is another point to exactly what I was saying before. It's the Dhamma that is your real teacher. That is what everything else should be measured up against. Them. So the Buddha actually did lay these things down. And then the monks and the nuns, possibly also lay people, would recite these things. And they would be recited from generation to generation, from teacher to student. Sometimes they would come up together in large congregations and recite them together. Because when you come together in a large congregation, you weed out the errors, right? Because if one person gets it wrong, the others will carry it forward in the right way. So that's why you weed out the errors. And this way they kept it going until it could be written down. And it's fascinating because there are some very good scholars these days. There's one monk called Venerable Anala, who is a German monk. He's probably the world's leading scholar in comparative studies of the suttas. He compares the suttas in different recensions. He looks at the Pali, he looks at the Chinese, and he compares them. And by doing that, you can see the differences that have happened in the suttas over the centuries. And you find that there are sometimes some differences in the suttas. Now these different schools, they split apart from each other maybe 200 years after the Buddha. That was still during the period when the oral recension was happening. So when you look at the suttas, you see that some of those differences are very hard to explain unless you understand that oral recension is sometimes faulty. Sometimes your memory goes wrong. Sometimes you add things that shouldn't be there. And you can explain some of the mistakes, some of the faults that exist today through fault in memory at those early days that happened at that time. And you can see that through these comparative studies. But what the comparative studies also show, which is much more important, is that the Dhamma, the crux of the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, are identical across the different schools. And what that means, that even though they have stayed apart for 2,200 years, they're still the same. Isn't that amazing? 2,200 years, and they're still the same when you compare them. It's magnificent. And what that means is that what we have is the word of the Buddha, right? It must be, because it's so close to the Buddha. If we've been able to keep it together for 2,200 years, then surely they were able to keep it together for the 200 years prior to that. Probably more so, because in those days the Sangha was still very keen and very together and very organized. So probably more so. Does that explain answer your question, or maybe not quite? Yes, he did. He said to the monks, remember the suttas, learn the suttas. Pariyapunati is the Pali word, learn the suttas. And he says that that the sasana, the Dhamma, will decline unless you actually learn the suttas. There's another thing he said about this. Unless you learn these things, the sasana, the Dhamma, will decline. It's necessary to learn the suttas, it's required. Yes, sir. They say he probably spoke a dialect called the Magadhi language, because the Magadhi was like the, maybe not even quite Magadhi, he probably spoke something similar to Magadhi. Magadhi was the greatest kingdom at the time, it was the most powerful kingdom, and soon after the time of the Buddha, it took over pretty much all of India. So he probably spoke in that dialect, because that was the most powerful place at the time. And that is very close to Pali, but not identical. And the reason for that is because these texts were transmitted over a long time after the Buddha. Then they became more and more standardized, they became more and more artificial in a sense, because they were standardized in a language that they decided this should be the official language of the suttas. And eventually they were written down in that language. And that became Pali in the Sri Lankan school of Buddhism. And other schools of Buddhism, they use Sanskrit because they wanted to use an official language. They use Sanskrit. And in other places, they use other languages. They call it the Prakrit language. Prakrit means like the natural local languages. And they remember in those languages. And the Buddha always said, you should remember the Dhamma in the local language. That's one of the things he said. So that's why it had this spread in different languages. Then it went to China, and it was translated into Chinese. It went off to all other areas and translated into the local language, whatever it was in those places. So he spoke something very similar to Pali, and that's why the Pali canon is very important, because it is close to what the Buddha spoke. There's not much translation that has happened from the Buddha to the Pali canon. Yes?
I understand monks in Bodhiyana pay attention to Pali, like you just mentioned, and that you share knowledge translation from things like that. I'm just thinking though, compared to your comment earlier about the Chinese agamas and the Pali being pretty close together,
yeah.
I'm wondering how close is the English, current English translation?
Exactly, it's a very good point, isn't it? It's a very good point. Yeah, and this is, I think you're very right. And this is the thing, when I read any translations, often I think, this could have been done better, this could have been translated differently. Yeah. And this is even when somebody like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi does a translation, somebody who's an expert. It's not that I could do it better than Bhikkhu Bodhi. I could probably do it much worse. My point is that sometimes I pick up mistakes that he has made, it because everybody makes mistakes when they do translations. It's unavoidable. Man. So, yes, it is. This is one of the problems, and that is one of the problems why the Chinese probably is not as good, for understanding the suttas fully as the Pali is. The Pali is, I think, the ideal language, and I think if you read the Agamas in Chinese and you compare it with the Pali. Pali is more consistent, I think it is more, it is simpler, it is not as, I think it probably is better. But the nice thing about reading the Chinese and why it is so useful, very often the Chinese will actually show you mistakes that happen in the Pali through oral recension. You can use the Chinese to help you correct the Pali in certain ways. Just as you can use the Pali to correct the Chinese. When they publish the Agamas in Taiwan, for example, they always check with the Pali to understand the Chinese. With the Chinese, it can be very, very hard to understand it. I don't know, I'm no expert in this, but I'm told that reading, they call it Middle Chinese, the Chinese 1,500 years older, that is used for the suttas. No person who can read Chinese today, read Chinese characters, is able to understand that directly. Yeah. You have to be an expert in a particular field, and then you can actually understand it. Yeah. So yeah, they use the Pali to understand these things. In the same way, you use the Chinese to help you understand the Pali better. Yeah. But also in our monastery, it's true that we do learn Pali, but it's voluntary, you don't have to learn Pali. Yeah. Because some people don't have the kind of the interest, or they don't incline that way. Yeah. There's only those people who have a natural interest and actually do learn Pali. It's not compulsory. Yeah. But, yeah. Was that what you were asking? Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm asking, so how accurate are the English, current English translations?
Yeah, I think that the translations done by Bhikkhu Bodhi are very accurate. They're not bad. If you read that, you are basically reading what is in the Pali. It's not perfect, and you will never have a perfect translation, and that's why it's good to have people who learn Pali who can sort of double check what is going on. It's never going to be perfect. That's impossible. But they are very good. I think Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, as far as I'm concerned, are the best ones available. Yes.
Ajahn, I was just wondering, when you mentioned sutta, it's just the teaching, it doesn't include the monk's rules, does it? I'm just a bit confused.
Yeah, sure.
Where to stand? Because the suttas all contain very inspirational people, where even the worst people there are very honest.
Yeah.
So obviously it's not the case. Then, and I remember Ajahn Brahm saying that you read about Kalibak people,
and you go to the Vinayana school sometimes. Yeah. You can read the Vinayana if you're interested in it, if you find it it gives you something, it kind of adds something to your perspective, you can read that. But remember that the Vinaya is really a full monastic, so it talks about all kind of minor kind of rules and all kind of stuff. You may find it incredibly boring, to be honest. But you are certainly welcome to read it if you find it is useful. But it does come, most a lot of that comes from the Buddha, and some of it does not. And this is one of the kind of areas of scholarly research is able to sort of pull out what actually came from the Buddha and what was afterwards. And essentially, what seems to have come from the Buddha are what we call the Patimokkha rules. You know the Patimokkha rules? The actual rules themselves. This is essentially what the Buddha laid down. He also laid down a few other things like ordination procedure, a certain procedure that the Sangha should do to do certain things. He did that as well then. But other aspects of the Vinaya probably was not taught by the Buddha. For example, you can read the Patimokkha rules. They both mean origin story here. And some of those origin stories are very funny and very. You realize that when you read those, you know, people weren't that different at the time of the Buddha from there and now. They kind of went all kind of mischief, you know. So it wasn't as if everybody was enlightened at the time of the Buddha. They were just like people are today. Which is important to remember because it gives you the incentive to practice. You know, you're just like them. They can do it, you can do it, right? This is a good thing. But I can tell you that. You don't have to read all the Vinaya to see that. I can tell you that now. It's like you can skip the Vinaya. Skip the Vinaya. But yeah, so it's up to you if you want to read it or not. It's not off limits. Some of people think that the Vinaya is off limits for lay people. It's good for lay people to know a bit about the Vinaya, because if you know what the Vinaya says, you can also, if monks don't behave properly or nuns don't behave properly, you can actually know that. And it's important to know that. If you don't know that, you keep supporting the wrong kind of people or whatever. It's not such a good idea. It's good for lay people to know this. At least in general outline, not in all detail, but in general outline, I think it's useful. I was at a conference in Perth quite recently, and it was people from all over the world, you know, giving papers on Buddhism. There was this one layman from Kalmykia. Anybody here heard of Kalmykia before? Now? Have you heard of Kalmykia? Have you heard of it?
This is in the
Russian Republic. That's exactly right. Very well done. So it's close to the Caspian Sea. It's close to Chechnya, you know, where they have the wars and all kind of thing. And it's the only republic in Russia that is Buddhist, and actually is also in Europe. So it's actually the only nation in Europe that is Buddhist there. But anyway, this fellow from Kalmykia, I gave a talk at this place. I gave a presentation on the Vinaya, and I was basically saying, you know, that the Vinaya can be interpreted in many different ways. And when the Vinaya goes to a new country, you look at the Vinaya with fresh eyes, because interpretations vary. There is no such thing as, you may think that there is such a thing as one Vinaya, actually there isn't. It's all in interpretation. So I was saying, well, can we look at the Vinaya differently in Australia? So I talked about a few issues, and he was horrified. We can't talk about the Vinaya in front of lay people. That's terrible. This is kind of monk's business. It's a secret business. And that is, I think, is not good, because that is precisely the kind of thing that can lead to the decline of Buddhism. Because when lay people don't understand, then the monks often get slacker because they know they don't have to live up to the rules, and the whole thing can decline for that sort of reason. So it's good to know a little bit about monastic rules.
Yeah. Maybe open for one last
question there. Yes.
In the Mahayana, they have the Hatha Sutra titles. You think that how it is Theravada
Sutra? If you ask an historian who has looked into these issues, they will say that the Hatha Sutra and the Diamond Sutra were written long time after the Buddha. This is not the word of the Buddha. So what you have to do what most historians of these things will say are the authentic teachings of the Buddha are what we call the four Nikayas of the Pali. So Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanghita Nikaya, and the Anguttara Nikaya. That is the core teachings of the Buddha. And then there's also some aspects of the Vinaya, as I was explaining now. So this is where you really want to go. That doesn't mean, I haven't read the Heart Sutra, I probably should have, I'm probably not all that educated that I should be in these things, but that doesn't mean that all of these latest sutras necessarily are wrong. It's like the Abhidhamma. Sometimes we're talking about the Abhidhamma. Is the Abhidhamma all wrong? Well, that's not really the point. The point isn't that it's all wrong. The point is it wasn't sent by the Buddha. And sometimes it's very hard to know which parts are right, and perhaps there are some wrong parts. How do you know which parts are wrong? It takes an enormous amount of study, because these words are very complicated. And then you have people who explain to you why it isn't wrong after all, because somehow, and eventually they're headache because they try to figure it all out. So instead of trying to figure out what is right and what is wrong, it's better to say, well, I know this is the word of the Buddha. So let me just go there. Let me find my inspiration there. Let me just put this other thing to one side. I don't have to decide whether it's right or wrong here. I will go to what I know with most certainty is right. And there I will get my inspiration. That, I think, that is how I go about these things. And I think it's a nice way, without kind of upsetting too many people and saying, whatever is, you know, all that Abhidhamma thing is wrong, which you can't say anyway, which would be wrong to say. So you say that, I'll just put it to one side and focus on the sutras.
But the Mahayana says that
Buddha
is speaking very,
seriously. Yeah. It's because they have a very different idea of Buddha's history than what we have in Theravada Buddhism. And their idea of Buddha's history is that these suttas were like, one of the explanations they have, that these suttas were kept in a different realm, like in the heavenly realm or something, and then later on they were discovered and brought back to humanity, etc., etc. I don't find that very convincing, and I don't believe it, to be honest with you. I think what is much more likely, and you can see the style is different. If it was, you know, if it was from the same time, and it was actually given in the heavenly, given and put away in the heavenly realm, at least the style would be the same. It isn't the same at all. It's a very different style. The language is different. The vocabulary is different. Everything is different about these things, and that is the kind of indication that these were written at another time. It's the same with the Abhidhamma. The way, the reason you know the Abhidhamma is not the word of the Buddha is when you start reading it, this is a completely different type of text. It's very different. That's number one. The second thing is the words that use there are very different from the words in the suttas. The very vocabulary is completely different. The overlap isn't that much. The way things are phrased, the whole sentence, everything around it is different. And the more you see that these things are very different, the more you realize that it belongs to a different period of time. It's just like, you know, in English literature, if you read Shakespeare and you read Dickens, the language has changed. It's not because Shakespeare was such a genius that he could write in many different styles. Shakespeare only wrote in one style. He used the language of the time. And Dickens wrote in his own style later on. And language changed. Because language changed, we can trace that change in the various scriptures. Happy with that? You don't look quite happy. Do you? Look,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is the thing is that in the Theravada Buddhism, the word emptiness is the same as the word non-self. It means the same thing, it refers to the same thing. The Buddha says somewhere explicitly that the world is empty of a self and what belongs to a self. That's why it's called empty. Yeah? That's what empty means. But in Mahayana Buddhism, that concept is taken a bit further. Yeah? And it's taken further to mean also other things. I must admit, I'm a little bit on thin ice if I try to sort of expand on this. It is a little bit beyond my area of study. But they take it further, and they take the idea of emptiness in a slightly different way. Yeah? And again, this is because of evolution of ideas. Things change over time. But both Mahayana Buddhism and the Theravada Buddhism agree here that emptiness certainly means empty of itself. There's no doubt about that.
So thank you for the wonderful. May I invite Ajahn to close the session with sharing merit and also.
Yeah. Okay. Which sharing merit to the Tathagata.
Ajahn Brahm.
Okay, well, let's do it in English because it's more meaningful in English. So, just close your eyes and just say to yourself, I share all the merits of my life, of my virtue, of my practice, of my metta, of my kindness, of my goodness, with all, first of all, my family members, departed ones, but also with all other beings. Okay, so let's just do the homage of the triple check.
Thank you.